So yeah, I started reading Isaiah this spring, and I was all excited because it's been a little while since I read it, you know, and I was remembering the good bits. The unto us a child is born, and the people walking in darkness have seen a great light, and freedom from the captives, and instead of their shame, they'll receive a double portion. And I'd forgotten how much really heavy stuff there is, especially in the first half. And I'm kind of dragging through it, reading it devotionally. It's like, okay, God, I believe you speak through the whole Bible, but really? Really more of this? Do we really need this many chapters about all this heavy stuff? You know, there's just so much stuff about idols. And it's easy to dismiss it because you think, well, we don't have idols. We don't have little shrines in our houses with little gold statues and wooden statues or whatever. Although, actually, I was friends with a Hindu woman. Dan's mom introduced me. This was a while ago. And she started coming to our Monday women's group. And she invited me into her home one day. And she said, oh, and this is our shrine. And they were Hindu. And I'd never seen one before. It was like it had all the little gods. And she's like, this is the god of this. And this is the god of that. And this is... You know, it's like right here in Madison. But anyway, most of us, she did end up coming to Christ. That's a good part. But most of us don't have that in our house, right? You know, we don't have idols, right? So I got to chapter 46 and read it. And honestly, I'm thinking, really, God, more about idols? And I just felt like God sort of cleared his throat a little bit and said, well, you know, maybe you need to listen. And I was really convicted. I was thinking, oh, gosh, yeah, well, maybe I do need to listen. So I started really meditating on chapter 46. It's kind of one of those, okay, God, I'm listening. Let's deal with this stuff. What do you want to say about idols? So we're going to read chapter 46 all the way through, and then we'll come back and kind of walk through it slowly. It's not a super long chapter. Don't panic. So Isaiah 46. Bel bows down, Nebo stoops. Their idols are on beasts and livestock. These things you carry are borne as burdens on weary beasts. They stoop, they bow down together. They cannot save the burden, but themselves go into captivity. Listen to me, O house of Jacob, all the remnant of the house of Israel who have been born by me from before your birth, carried from the womb, even into your old age, I am he, and to gray hairs I will carry you. I have made, and I will bear. I will carry, and will save. To whom will you liken me and make me equal and compare me, that we may be alike? Those who lavish gold from the purse and weigh out silver in the scales hire a goldsmith, and he makes it into a god. Then they fall down and worship. They lift it to their shoulders. They carry it. They set it in place, and it stands there. It cannot move from its place. If one cries to it, it does not answer or save him in his trouble. Remember this and stand firm. Recall to mind, you transgressors. Remember the former things of old. For I am God, and there is no other. I am God, and there is none like me, declaring the end from the beginning, and from ancient times things not yet done, saying, my counsel shall stand, and I will accomplish my purpose, calling a bird of prey from the east and a man of my counsel from a far country. I have spoken, and I will bring it to pass. I have purposed, and I will do it. Listen to me, you stubborn of heart, you who are far from righteousness. I bring near my righteousness. It is not far off, and my salvation will not delay. I will put salvation in Zion for Israel my glory. So how's all that sound to you? Because I've been reading it a lot, so but I think the first time I read it, it was kind of like, whoa, it's kind of a lot to take in. So we'll take it chunk by chunk and go through it. So it starts out in verses 1 and 2, and it says, Bel bows down, Nebo stoops. Their idols are on beasts and livestock. These things you carry are borne as burdens on weary beasts. They stoop, they bow down together. They cannot save the burden, but themselves go into captivity. See, at this point, when Isaiah's writing, rather, Israel's been conquered by the Babylonian Empire, and most of them have been carried off into captivity in Babylon, most of the people from the nation. So Bel and Nebo are Babylonian gods. Bel was actually the city god of Babylon, so he was kind of like the head god, as it were, and Nebo was Bel's son. So he was the city god of Borsippa, which, no, I hadn't heard of it either. But anyway, it's a city near Babylon, and he was the god of writing and wisdom. And what they used to do was every year they would bring his image back into Babylon for this big annual procession. And he would supposedly write on the tables of destiny the fates decreed by the gods for the coming year. And I have a feeling this is probably very political. You know, it's probably really convenient for the leaders because, let's face it, Nebo didn't write a thing. So who do you think's writing it? Well, the leaders, oh, the god said. It's not us. The god said. And that's how they control the people with the gods, right? So, but the Babylonian Empire, powerful as it was about to be conquered by the Persian Empire. So this passage is looking ahead, and it's prophetically speaking about how those Babylonian gods that people are bowing down to, they themselves will be bowing down to the Persian gods when they come in. And so, and they won't be able to save Babylon. And there's this double meaning because it's speaking about back then, the historical details of those particular idols, but it's also speaking in general about idols and their inability to save, and that's just as relevant today. And we don't really talk too much about idols in America. It's not a super popular subject. And actually, when we do talk about idols, it's positive, isn't it? You know, we've got American Idol and all of this. And I actually found an article in ABC News that talks about celebrity culture. This is how it starts out. And it's from 2009, so some of the people they mentioned. But that's only 5 years ago. It's still relevant, right? It says, in America these days, idols are everywhere. Music idols like Britney and Madonna. Sports idols like, and I'm not a sports person, Jada? I don't know. It was 5 years ago. Apparently that idol has now gone by the wayside. Anyway, him and Manning. Fashion idols like Gucci, Armani, and Prada. We even have television shows to make our own American Idol. It's as if there is a need, a hunger in America to idolize. Isn't that interesting? It's as if there's a need, a hunger in America to idolize. And it's easy to think, well, it's just pop culture. You know, it's just fun. But we're forgetting the first two commandments, aren't we? Right there in Exodus, when Moses gets the Ten Commandments, Exodus chapter 20, verses 3 through 6, it says, you shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make for yourself a carved image or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above or that is in the earth beneath or that is in the water under the earth. You shall not bow down to them or serve them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God. And it goes on from there. God takes this really seriously, this idol stuff. And, you know, we're really big on some of the commandments, like don't murder, don't steal, don't commit adultery. But we need to take them all seriously, right? This is a big deal to God. It comes first in the Ten Commandments. And I think we don't think so much about idolatry because it's so subtle. It's not the obvious making of a carved image and setting it up on a shrine in our home or visiting a temple and bowing down to it and worshiping it. The language has changed and the form has changed, but idolatry is still there. And we often get sucked into the idol worship of the culture around us. You know, just like the Israelites, they were captives in Babylon, and they're surrounded by all the Babylonian gods. Well, we as Christians live in a foreign culture, so to speak, and we very easily get sucked into that. So what do we worship? What are our Baals and our Nebos? Well, I can't really give you a list. We can't really come up with here's the list of idols to avoid, and then post it on the website and have all the members sign, no, we won't worship these, you know? Because the thing is, idolatry is not about the thing. It's not about the idol. It's about our attitude to it. Idolatry is kind of sneaky, and that's why we don't notice it, because it usually starts out with something that really is good. It's a gift that God gave us, or it's a tool that he gave us. And it's something that we enjoy, but at some point, we cross a line. And instead of it being a gift, it becomes an idol. And really, the difference is the point at which we cross that line is what's going on inside of us. So one person's joy may be another person's idol. And my joy yesterday may become my idol today. Idols are only idols if we idolize them. So what is idolatry? Well, it's anything that takes a part of our hearts and lives that rightfully belongs to God. Idolatry is expecting anything other than God to save us, rescue us, sustain us, provide for us, protect us, bring us joy and peace. These places in our hearts are supposed to be reserved for God. He's supposed to bring us those things. Now, he may choose to sustain us and protect us and provide for us and bless us through those gifts and tools. And they're not bad in themselves. But anytime we step over from viewing those things as tools and helpful things and good things to viewing them as the source itself of all those things that we're looking for, anytime that we displace God from being all of those things in our lives, we step over into idolatry. So anytime that we rely on our job to provide, God may provide through our job, but he's the provider. He's just using the job as a tool. The job itself does not provide. Anytime we look to our insurance or our good choices to protect us, anytime that we look to our image or our reputation or success, suppose, you know, what is success anyway, but success to determine our value, our family or our job or our ministry or anything else, if we start looking to that to give us purpose and meaning, if we start looking to alcohol and drugs to get us through the day and to make us feel good, if we start looking at our savings account to give us peace and security, if we start relying on our own strength to give us perseverance, or if we even start relying on our preferred form of worship, whatever that is, to bring us into God's presence and help us feel close to him. God does want us to be responsible. He does want us to be good stewards of the things that he gives us and of the people in our lives. But this isn't about saying, well, I'm just going to depend on God. I'm never going to do anything. I can just be lazy. Because worshiping God and doing the work that he calls us to do really do go hand in hand. But this is about a heart issue. How do we view these things? Are they good things or are they idols? It's really interesting if you notice in those first two verses, there's this little transition that happens. Let me just read it again. Bel bows down, Nabo stoops. Their idols are on beasts and livestock. These things you carry are borne as burdens on weary beasts. They stoop, they bow down together. They cannot save the burden, but themselves go into captivity. See, there's this shift that happens. These things that we lean on and depend on, these idols, they kind of do a twist and become snares that entrap us. So instead of them being good gifts and good tools that God's given us, we start expecting them to carry us, to save us, to be dependable and trustworthy. And so we start leaning on them and expecting them to carry us, but then this thing happens and we find, wait a minute, they're not carrying me, I'm carrying them. Suddenly I've got this big burden that I'm carrying around, and it's really heavy because they're not worthy of the trust that we put in them. And I can give you some examples. There's probably lots more, but just to sort of help us get our brains and hearts around this, one example could be our image. You know, trying to maintain a particular image can become an idol. It could be your own image that you want to project to the world. It could be your professional work image. It could be our image as a church. You know, and it's good to want to represent God well. It's good to want excellence. But we can take that shift and it can become something that we worship and we start to take pride in. And then it becomes heavy and burdensome and it's hard work. We got to maintain it. We got to keep it up, right? Technology is another one. Technology is fabulous. You know, you can stay connected with friends. You can communicate easily with people. It's a really great tool. But then there's this thing that happens when, oh man, I've got to keep up on email and I've got 3 different accounts and I've got Twitter and I've got Facebook and I've got Instagram and text messages. Blah! And suddenly it's become this heavy, burdensome thing that's sucking all our resources and it's become an idol. Even our house. You know, a house is a great place to live, a place for security, a place to be hospitable, a place to have family, whatever that is. You know, it's a good thing. But then if we've got too much house, we can feel like, oh, this has become such a burden, and now I have to maintain it and keep it up, and I got to keep it looking as nice as everybody else's house, and it just becomes this big, heavy thing. We actually had a family in the church a few years ago who they realized that they'd done that. They'd bought up and bought up and bought up, and they were living in the fancy house in the fancy neighborhood, and it was like, man, we're just working so hard to pay this mortgage, and this has just become ridiculous. And they had the courage to say, This is stupid. We don't need this. Why are we worshiping this image and this house? And so they downsized and they bought a smaller house, still in a fine neighborhood. There's nothing wrong with it. Plenty of space for their family. And they just felt so free. It was like, why did we think we had to carry that thing, you know? Even a job, as I said, you know, that can become an idol. We need financial provision. God knows we need that. And he made us to work. He made us to have something that's meaningful and satisfying in our lives through working. But it can become, again, a heavy burden if we're desperate to maintain it. Oh, I've got to climb the ladder. I've got to compete with everybody else and make sure that I'm, you know, that I'm really keeping up on this job. And, oh, man, what if I lose my job? And we forget that God's the provider, not the job. And it becomes this idol that we're worshiping as a provider in our lives. It's not the provider. God's just using that to provide for us. Even education. Education's a great way to prepare and help us become more of who God made us to be. But it can become an idol if we feel like, oh, I've got to get into a certain school, and so I've got to do all these things to get into that school. You know, I've got to build the portfolio. You're no longer living life. You're building a portfolio. You know, I'm not doing this because I want to do it. I'm doing it because it'll look good on the list, on the resume when I fill in the college application. And then at the end of it, depending on what degree you've got, you may have a great education and you may just have a pile of debt and no job, right? So even that can become an idol. It's not, none of these things are bad things, see? There's just this subtle shift that can happen from enjoying them to worshiping them. So what feels heavy to you in life? What good gifts and tools has God given you that have become lead weights that you're dragging with you through life? What aspect of your life or work has become burdensome because you're idolizing just some part of it, maybe? What do you find yourself trying to juggle or balance or maintain and support that just feels like cement? Well, fortunately, the passage doesn't end there. So verses 3 and 4. Listen to me, O house of Jacob, all the remnant of the house of Israel who have been born by me from before your birth, carried from the womb. Even to your old age, I am he, and to gray hairs, I will carry you. I have made and I will bear, I will carry and will save. See, God switches it back around. Isn't that cool, the way God does that? God always redeems even burdens that feel impossible to lift, as if we swallowed mercury and it settled down in our ankles and we're dragging it there. He carries us. From conception to grave, he carries us and he saves us. Verse 4 says, he made us and he takes responsibility for everything and everyone that he's made. He saves, he rescues, he bears the burden. And doesn't that sound like what Jesus said in Matthew 11? He said, come to me, all who labor and are heavy laden, for I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and lowly in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy, my burden is light. Do we have a sense that we're carrying heavy burdens? Or that we are being carried by God and saved, whether it's from sin, from ourselves, from our burdens, on a daily basis. And honestly, I've experienced both. I've had those days when I'm overwhelmed, I'm stressed, I'm trying to keep it all together, I've got too much to do, and it's just hard, right? And then I have days when I bring it to God and I say, God, this is just too heavy for me. It's too much. I can't do it. I really need your help. I really need you to give me the resources I need, whether it's the energy, the emotional energy, the finances, the time, whatever it is. God, I need you. And then I have this sense of being carried through the day. I've literally had that feeling of being carried. And to the outside observer, there may not be any difference between the 2 days. It doesn't necessarily take the hard stuff away, but somehow it isn't a burden. And somehow I've got a different kind of grace and a different just kind of ability to cope and stay a little calmer, laugh things off. It just feels different. He carries us. He saves us. That's what these verses say. We just have to let him. So often we're like a toddler, aren't we? Put me down. I can do it myself, right? Will you let God carry you? We have all sorts of reasons, don't we, for not wanting God to carry us, and that's what the next verses talk about. Verses 5 through 7. To whom will you liken me and make me equal, and compare me that we may be alike? Those who lavish gold from the purse and weigh out silver on the scales, hire a goldsmith, and he makes it into a god, then they fall down and worship. They lift it to their shoulders, they carry it, they set it in its place, and it stands there. It cannot move from its place. If one cries out to it, it does not answer or save him from his trouble. God's saying, let's do a comparison. Who are you going to compare me to? Let's weigh this out. God versus the gods. And there's other places in Scripture where God held a little contest. You may remember Elijah with the prophets of Baal. So this was a little earlier on when Israel was worshiping other idols, the Baals. So Elijah sets up this contest. Let's settle this once and for all, people. Let's see who's really God, if Baal is God or if God is God. So he says, here's what we'll do. Two altars, two identical altars, two identical animals of sacrifice, the same wood underneath, and we're going to set them up. And then you pray to Baal and ask him to send down fire for the sacrifice, okay? And then I'll pray to God and ask him to send down fire for the sacrifice, and we'll see who wins. So he says, because, you know, Elijah's very polite about this, he says, you go first. So these prophets of Baal, they're calling out to Baal, they're praying, send down fire, and they're even whipping themselves and cutting themselves. Cutting is not new, guys. They're cutting themselves, all this. And Elijah starts teasing them and says, maybe you should yell a little louder. Maybe he's gone on vacation. Maybe he's in the bathroom. It's there, really. That's what it says. So he says, you know, just call it. So they're screaming and yelling, and what's happening? Well, nothing, right? So then it's great, because what he does is he gets gallons and gallons and gallons of water, douses the altar, and then says, God, would you show off a little? It explodes with fire. It's just great. Settles it right there. But don't we do the same? We call out to our idols saying, oh, save me. And we expect them to save us. We have this sense of sort of fairness and justice, and these idols should save me. You know, the government, they should take care of me, or whatever problem it is. They should do something. And we're really idolizing government when we do that, right? Or my savings account, it should be there to save me. And actually, we finally have a little savings account. Well, right now we do, until Craig gets his 2 crowns this week. And then I feel this sense of injustice, like, I shouldn't have to spend that on 2 crowns. I don't begrudge you your crowns. It could just as easily be me. But, you know, it's like, instead of that kind of, wow, well, thank goodness we've got it, it's like, really? You know, well, what's it for? Anyway, I guess I'm idolizing the savings account. I'll repent, okay? Oh, you know, it can be our lifestyle. We can say, well, I didn't smoke and I've stayed healthy. Why should I have cancer? It's not fair, right? You know? Or we can look at our wisdom and our education and we can say, it should save me, you know? And in verse 7 it says, if one cries out to it, it does not answer or save him from his trouble. These things we cry out to, they don't save us. God may use those things to help us, but they themselves are powerless, and we certainly can't rely on them. There are no substitutes for God himself. Idols cannot even compete. You know, they don't even qualify to participate in the race. When you have the Olympics and you have the qualifying heats to see who even gets to be in the Olympics, if God was having a God Olympics, the idols wouldn't even make it through the qualifying heats. Actually, the Olympics would be a little bit of a non-event because the only competitor would be God. And he would do the sprint in 0 seconds, and he'd do the marathon in 0 seconds, and then in the high jump, he'd jump infinity, and the long jump, he'd jump from east to west, and it would just be, you know, and then the team sports, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit would team up, and it would just be, you know, I mean, who can compete against that, right? And we laugh, but really, we act as if there are other things that are sort of in the running with God, and they're not. Man-made things cannot save. The finances, the systems, the structures, the organization charts, even in the church, our good leadership and mentorship and discipleship and worship, all these little ships set sail, and they become these little sacred cows of how we do church. And it says in verse 7, they set it in its place, it stands there, it cannot move from its place. And any time I think we've got something set in stone, that we've got these protocols and have-tos, they probably become idols. We have to do it this way. We always do it this way. The things that we create are not greater than us. They can't save us. Nothing compares to God himself. So we have to take care to keep God front and center. Not the programs and the systems, not any of the things that God gives us, not the ways of doing life right, however good and however godly they are. And there's another place in the Bible where there was a contest between God and a god, little g, and that's in the book of Daniel. So King Nebuchadnezzar, he set up an idol. By the way, Nebuchadnezzar was named after Nebo. I'm named after that god. No wonder he had a god complex. We can't really blame the guy. But he set up, his advisor said to him, why don't you set up a statue for everyone to worship? And he said, oh yeah, sounds like a good idea. And then if people don't worship it, why don't you just throw them in a fiery furnace? He's like, oh yeah, sounds like a good idea. Anyway, that was what he said. If people refused to worship the idol, they would have to go into the fiery furnace. So three fine young Israelite men who had been taken in captivity into Babylon, they said, we won't worship that idol. We're not going to do it. Even though they were going to die if they didn't. It's like, whoa. So I love what they said. In chapter 3, verses 17 and 18, it says, this is them speaking. They said, if this be so, meaning if we're going to be thrown into the furnace, if we don't worship, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. But if not, even if he doesn't, be it known to you, O king, that we will not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up. I love what they said here. They have absolute confidence that God will deliver them. It's a furnace. I mean, really? Wow. They have absolute confidence that God is going to deliver them. But even if he doesn't, they say, but even if not, we will not worship those gods. They would rather die than worship those gods because they know it's better to worship God. They've got an eternal view of things, not just an earthly thing. It would have been so easy for them to say, oh, well, look, guys, let's just pretend to worship the God. We don't have to really worship him. You know, it's a hard thing. So we can bow down and pretend, you know, nobody will really know. And, you know, God wouldn't want us to die because he loves us, right? But that's man's wisdom. That's not God's wisdom. I wonder how many miracles I've missed out on because I wasn't that ruthless in following my God 100%. Really convicting.
We all fall prey to idol worship when it isn't clear in our minds and hearts that God is best. They had it absolutely clear that following God was the best. See, we believe and know all sorts of stuff in our heads, don't we? God's trustworthy. God has a plan. God's good. He's loving. He's strong. He's powerful. He's dependable. Woo! Yay, God! But then we don't necessarily trust and put our absolute faith in him to be all those things for us when the rubber meets the road, right? So, yeah, I know God's good, but yes, I know this is how God says I should live, but I believe God has a plan, but I don't want to wait that long, so I'll just go ahead with my plan. I'll just have sex now instead of waiting. I'll just go into debt instead of saving, .. right? Yeah, I know I can trust God, but I'd still like to work 7 days a week and build up a nice big savings account. So instead, we need to be absolutely ruthless in trusting and following God, right? We have to be so convinced of who God is and trust that he will save us and rescue us. But even in the most extreme case, if he doesn't, if we end up dead or in prison or even just ostracized or with less success, that we will still refuse to worship anything or anyone else. And we will only worship him because honoring him and following him is more important than anything that we could either enjoy or endure in this life. So to keep ourselves from idol worship, we have to keep growing in knowing and trusting all of God's character, knowing that in the big picture of eternity, he is worth following. That's what we say when we sing, he is worthy. He's worth it. He's worth following. He's worth trusting, worth worshiping. Yes, he does save us and carry us and help us now. But even when it looks like in the short term, as if he's not there, we're going to trust his timing and we're going to continue to worship and follow him. We have to keep playing out that God Olympics in our minds. God is ultimately going home with the gold, all the gold, every medal for every event throughout our lives. And it may seem like our idol, that thing that we're depending on or choosing to do instead of following God's way, it may seem like that wins in the moment, in that qualifying heat. But how's it going to play out? Ultimately, that thing will fail us. God will win. His ways will triumph. So this is what Isaiah says as he goes on. He says, remember this and stand firm. Recall it to mind, you transgressors. Remember the former things of old. For I am God, there is no other. I am God, and there is none like me, declaring the end from the beginning and from ancient times things not yet done, saying, my counsel shall stand, and I will accomplish all my purpose, calling a bird of prey from the east, a man of my counsel from a far country. I have spoken, and I will bring it to pass. I have purposed, and I will do it. In verse 11, when God talks about bringing a bird of prey from the east, he's talking about the Persian Empire that's going to come and conquer the Babylonian Empire, and that is what happened. Babylon was very proud, and they believed that they were it, just like our Western civilizations tend to believe, like, yeah, we're it. And our idols that we've built up may seem dependable. They may seem to work for a while, but they will always fail in the long run. Whether it's social security or retirement or health, we can do whatever we can responsibly to live well, but ultimately the only thing worthy of trust and worship is God. God does have an eternal purpose. It's unwavering. It's consistent. It's unthwartable. Yep, I just wanted to say that word. Isn't that great? Unthwartable. It cannot be thwarted. Anytime you get three consonants in a row, it just makes a great sound. Thwarted. It can't be thwarted. So hopefully you'll remember that now. He's unthwartable. God has no empty words. Anything that he says, he's either done already, he is doing now, or he will do. All his words stand. None of his words are just going to come to nothing. Every promise that he's given us is true. He says, my counsel shall stand and I will accomplish all my purpose. So we need to know God's counsel and purpose. We carry such weights because we drift into idol worship. We're not grounded in that counsel and purpose. Often we don't see God's words fulfilled in the moment. So rather than waiting for his purpose and his timing, we just settle for doing things our own way. And then we carry the weight of the consequences of that. Instead, he wants us to worship and wait. There's that song, I will worship while I'm waiting, right? With this sense of anticipation and wonder and trust, my God will come through for me. So what's he spoken? Well, what does this book say? What counsel does it give us? What's God doing that he invites us into? What's he spoken to you personally? What have trusted friends and mentors and pastors and leaders prayed over you? What counsel has he given you about how you should live? What purpose has he given you personally? We need to know these things, and we need to remind ourselves of these things. It says, remember, stand firm. We need to not be distracted by idols, by other things. God's counsel and purpose will stand. Those are the things that matter, that have eternal value. So we hear all this, and if you're like me, I get to this point in the chapter, and I just start to bury myself under a mountain of guilt. You know, it's honestly, when I really started meditating through this, it was like, oh, wow, God. I had no idea that I was so into idol worship. I'm so sorry it took me 46 chapters to deal with this. But I'm glad it did, because this chapter has some really good handles for what we do with that. But it can be really overwhelming when God starts to identify and show each of us our idols. And then we also become aware that, wow, there's probably idols I'm not even aware of that are there. But we trust God will show them to us. But when I start to feel that overwhelming flood of self-condemnation, what I usually do is ask God to be specific. Because I know that he does not want to condemn us. He does want to convict us of specific sins and specific idols so that we can confess them, be forgiven of them, and be set free of them. So I felt like God wanted to show me some specific areas where I can start to idolize myself and idolize right living. And I start feeling good about myself on that basis, which of course only lasts till the next time that I mess up. Rather than enjoying worshiping him and living in deep gratitude for the righteousness that Jesus gives me. So I ask God, what should I do with my idolatry? And God doesn't usually speak to me in alliteration, but he did for whatever reason. He gave me 7 words, all beginning with P, of who he wants to be in my life. Areas where he wants to be my God. Areas where I can easily slip into idolatry and he wants to be my soul worship and my dependence. So he wants to be my purpose. He wants to be the reason that I live, the thing that drives me forward. He wants to be my purpose in life. He wants to be my pilgrimage. He wants me to be on a pilgrimage towards him and with him. He wants to be with me in the journey. He wants to be my perseverance. He wants to be that strength, that thing that gives me the endurance to carry on and persevere when things get difficult. He is my provider. He's the one who provides for everything that I need in life. He's my portion. You know, we sing and we like to say that Jesus is enough. And portion for me is a little different from provider because it gives me the portion. He gives me the portion that's for me. He gives me specifically the gifts and skills that I need. And he is always enough. He's my proprietor. We don't use that word very much, but to me that says he owns me. I belong to him. He is in charge. What he says goes. He's my position. My value, my image, my identity is in him. He puts me in my position in life, in the world, in his kingdom. And he is my peace. He is the only place I'm really secure and safe and can be calm and free from anxiety. So it makes sense that the answer to idolatry is to worship God, right? So what aspects of his character does he want you to worship? He gave me 7, and they all begin with P. But he may give you different words, and he may give you different aspects of who he is that he wants you to worship instead of idolizing anything else. And that's okay, even if they don't begin with the letter P. See, when I worship him, the idols become just things. They're gifts from God. They go back to being the tools and the good things that he's given me. They lose their idol status, and they lose their weight. Instead of being heavy burdens that I'm lugging around, they become light and easy, just like Matthew 11. So if that sounds simplistic and you feel like you've got a long way to go, well, we need to finish the chapter. Verses 12 and 13. Listen to me, you stubborn of heart. Yeah, we don't like hearing that, but we are, aren't we? You who are far from righteousness. I bring near my righteousness. It is not far off, and my salvation will not delay. I will put salvation in Zion for Israel, my glory. However far we are from God, however unrighteous, however far we've wandered into idolatry, righteousness is always near. We just call for it, and it's there. That's God's promise. He said, and Ephesians 2:13 basically says the same thing. It says, but now in Christ Jesus, you who were once far off have been brought near by the blood of Christ. We may feel far off, but it's only because we're looking in the wrong direction. God seems far away, but it's only because we're busy looking at our idols. If we just turn around to him, he's right there. Right behind us, just waiting for us to look at him. However far we've wandered, however many idols we've chased, however long our journey away from him has been, the journey back's always short. He's right there. And salvation is always instant. That's the other thing this says in verse 13. My salvation will not delay. We're never left hanging. When we ask God for forgiveness, when we come back to him and say, I really want to worship only you, he doesn't say, well, let me think about that for a while. Well, how about you demonstrate that for a while, and then I'll think about forgiving you. It's like, no, as soon as you say sorry, yep, it's done. We don't have to wait for some lengthy trial over years and months. The trial is done. Jesus has already paid for it. So we just have to ask for it. And there it is, forgiveness, instant, right away. We don't have to earn it. We don't have to change in order to be forgiven. We confess, we ask God to forgive us, and he does it right away. And then he helps us change. We ask God to forgive us our idols, and he does. And then he helps us learn to worship him and trust him in those areas where we've been worshiping and trusting idols. So if the worship team wants to come back up, we're going to end with communion today. We're going to do it just a little bit differently. So we're going to have a couple songs to end. I know, Living Dangerously, 2 songs instead of 1. Radical, yeah. But what I want you to do is to take some time to ask God to show you your idols. Where have you crossed that line from enjoying a gift that God gives you, something good, and using the tools that he's given you to idolizing them and trusting and worshiping and depending on them above God? What are you carrying that's become a heavy burden because it's become an idol? Where do you need to let God carry you instead of you carrying the weight? And where is God asking you to turn around and see how close he is? How ready and quick he is to forgive you. Tell him you're sorry. Ask him to show you how to worship him. What aspects of his character do you need to know and love and worship and cling to and depend on? For me, it's those letter P's, but for you it could be other things. But where does he want to be? Your purpose, your perseverance, your provider, your pilgrimage, your proprietor, your position, your peace. And then when you're ready, come and take communion. Just as we depend on food and drink to keep us alive, taking communion reminds us that we depend on Jesus' body and blood for our life and salvation. We worship him alone. So take the bread and dip it in the cup as a sign that you want to turn away from whatever idols he's shown you and return to worshiping only him. None of us do this perfectly, but we come forward to say, God, I want to worship only you. My heart's desire is to worship only you, and I believe you can help me do that. If you're not ready to lay down your idols, God does want you to be honest, so don't feel pressured to come take communion. But I pray that you will take this opportunity to lay down idols that are weighing you down and let God carry you and bring you the freedom and joy and forgiveness that he wants to give you.